From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Yemen today, security forces apprehended another top al-Qaeda member, Mohammed Hamdi al-Hadal, is suspected of masterminding the bombing attacks on the USS Cole in 2000 and the French oil tanker Limburg off the coast of Yemen in 2002. He was on the American short list of wanted al-Qaeda operatives. But whittling down the al-Qaeda hierarchy no longer guarantees victory in the struggle against terrorism, our guest tonight says. British journalist Jason Burke believes that al-Qaeda has already spawned copycat organizations that take little more than inspiration from the original movement centered around Osama bin Laden. These smaller, more local terrorist groups may prove just as deadly if not stopped, he says. But this free-form terrorist movement cannot be captured. It must be won over. They're not al-Qaeda, Burke says, but a new wave of terrorists inspired by, but not part of, bin Laden's organization. Tonight on Point, the al-Qaeda effect and terror without masterminds. Do you think it will be harder to fight? Al-Qaeda, or which do you think? Al-Qaeda or a legion of autonomous copycats? And how can the United States and its allies most effectively rein in nearly spontaneous spread of terrorism? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from London is Jason Burke, correspondent for The Observer newspaper and author of Al-Qaeda Casting a Shadow of Terror. Good evening and welcome, Jason Burke.
Good evening. Hi.
Hi. Thanks very much for joining us there. Also on the line with us tonight from Washington, D.C. is Steve Simon, senior analyst at the Rand Institute and co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, Radical Islam's War Against America. Good evening and welcome, Steve Simon.
Hi there.
Thanks for joining us. Jason Burke, to you first. We have seen a lot of terror attacks in recent weeks, most notably in Istanbul. As I understand it, you're saying, watch out, this is not just al-Qaeda. What are we seeing here?
Well, what we're seeing is that the hard core of al-Qaeda, the thing that's normally conceived of as al-Qaeda, is effectively out of commission. What we're seeing is people responding to the ideology of al-Qaeda, al-Qaeda as an idea, as a way of interpreting the world, and acting on their own accord. This is what bin Laden has always called for. He's always asked for people to go out and do things of their own accord. The idea that he's always been directly responsible for commissioning and executing attacks is misplaced. What he's always done is trying to radicalize and mobilize the Muslim world so that they go out, other people who've hitherto rejected his extremist message, go out and commit attacks. And I think that's what we're seeing in Istanbul, that's what we saw in Casablanca, that's what we saw in Riyadh, and that's what we saw elsewhere. It's people acting in the style of al-Qaeda, along the agenda of al-Qaeda, but not actually directed by al-Qaeda.
If that's true, Jason Burke, and we'll examine the premise tonight, but if it's true, is it a sign of weakness on al-Qaeda's part, that it's been battered down, or is it a sign of strength that it's managed to propagate that kind of activity beyond its own control?
Well, it depends what you mean by what you see as the aim of al-Qaeda. Bin Laden has been very clear with this. He's always said that his aim is to instigate. His aim is to radicalize and mobilize. So as far as he's concerned, things are going very well. He said in the autumn, in December, actually, 2001, at a time when he'd just escaped from the bombing at Tora Bora, he said, Osama's death is not relevant. Osama's life or death is not relevant. The awakening has started. And if you look around the Islamic world, you have to think that he was not so very far from saying something that was accurate. And that is a serious defeat for us in the war on terror, and in many ways a victory for the radicals.
Steve Simon, how do you see it? Every time, or very often, when these attacks occur, we hear it looks like al-Qaeda authorities say. Are they misinterpreting the reach of al-Qaeda? Do you see this as having gone beyond al-Qaeda, taken on a life of its own?
Well, the truth lies somewhere in between. As usual, the movement has indeed taken on a life of its own. Having said that, the movement had a life of its own before bin Laden got started. The movement really began, and that is in the Middle East, the movement began the decade before with an intifada, an insurgency in Egypt against first the Sadat government and then the Mubarak government. But having said that, there is a reason why at least some government or government intelligence services have tended to say in some cases that attacks are attributable to al-Qaeda in its original sense of this kind of band of criminals associated with bin Laden. And the reasons usually are two. One is modus operandi. If the attack resembles a classic al-Qaeda attack, that is to say simultaneity, the use of certain kind of weapons, or the demonstration of a certain kind of adaptiveness or creativity that smacks of al-Qaeda, people will say, well, you know, that's what it is, with some justification. But there's another reason as well, which is that in some cases, individuals who are at large and are known to be affiliated with that cadre, that core of al-Qaeda, are overheard to be saying things that show them to be complicit.
So you're saying this when we hear about chatter or particular messages overheard, are you suggesting that al-Qaeda may not be carrying out these terrorist acts, but may still be coordinating them?
They may be coordinating them, or as in the case of some attacks, a member of the group will come from a remote location, help pull things together, provide money at the last minute if it's required, advice or what have you, and then get out before the attack. So there is still evidence that in some of these attacks there's central direction. It's also worth noting that over against the fact that a number of the old guard, if we can put it that way, have been captured or killed, very few of them, in fact, I think only one of them, is from the Egyptian wing of al-Qaeda, and that's the dangerous one. Those guys are the stone killers who managed to escape from the grinding machine of the Egyptian secret police. And they're the ones with the operational skills that were honed in years of activity in Egypt and then Afghanistan. They seem largely, still to be out there.
Out there and operating. Jason Burke, let me put that to you. How much damage do you think American and other efforts have done to the al-Qaeda hierarchy? How big has the blow been? Describe it.
Well, I think I'm with Stephen on this in that what's happened is that the al-Qaeda hierarchy itself has been largely dispersed. Their ability to commission and execute attacks has been very seriously damaged in the last 2 years since we've seen the intervention in Afghanistan. The problem is that a lot of the attacks that they commissioned and that were attributed to al-Qaeda aren't actually al-Qaeda attacks. They're attacks by local Islamic militants. They're people who subscribe to al-Qaeda's ideas, but they're not actually involved in al-Qaeda as classically conceived.
So you're portraying them as kind of spontaneous in response to a general impulse or direction that's been articulated by bin Laden and others?
I think it's very clear that during the 90s, many, many people sought out bin Laden to get resources for their own ambitions, their own dreams of destruction, if you like. They went to Afghanistan to try and find someone who would help them with expertise, with logistics, with money, with arms, with explosives, to enable them to do what they wanted to do anyway. What we've seen since the dispersal of bin Laden in Afghanistan, or bin Laden's operations in Afghanistan, is that those people who had those ambitions still have those ambitions and are prepared to find somebody else to act on them or to help them with them if bin Laden is temporarily incapacitated, which appears to be the case. So it was always bigger than one man and one organization. And what we're seeing at the moment is certainly bigger than one man and one organization.
Jason Burke, the Washington Post quotes a senior Bush administration official saying that they believe that many of the leaders of these smaller regional groups had training at al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan. And he says that al-Qaeda's children are now growing up and moving out into the world loyal to their parents but no longer reliant on them. Do you see that degree of connection here?
I think it's beyond that. I think a lot of people who are now involved in Islamic militancy were never in the camps in Afghanistan. I think it's significant that in Istanbul you have one guy who was who appears to have been to, or one or two people who appears to have been to Afghanistan and Bosnia and Chechnya and so forth. The rest are homegrown militants. And we saw that in Casablanca in the spring. We saw guys who were had very tangential connections to anything in Afghanistan, to bin Laden himself, who were going out to cause their own problems, who were going out to cause their own to act according to their own agenda, to their own aggression, to their own problems, and that had very little to do with the inside cause of bin Laden.
Steve Simon, do you see the United States and others responding to this kind of dispersal? Is the U.S. still focused on tracking down one organization, one network, one octopus, or is it looking at this whole buffet of different semi-autonomous or autonomous groups?
No, I think they're looking at the whole smorgasbord. But they can't ignore the fact that members of the old guard or the second generation stemming from this old guard is still out there and very skilled and capable of turning the crank on operations. I think they would be imprudent to assume that they were completely gone. I think that they know, in fact, that they're not, and they'll continue to go after them. But my colleague Jason is correct in that the movement has metastasized, and quite considerably. It's a cancer in many places. The U.S. government is aware of this, and it has to count on one major factor that operates in America's favor, which is that the countries in which these people operate don't want them there any more than we want them there. So the U.S. gets a fair amount of cooperation from these countries. But you know, this is going to keep happening probably, you know, for a generation.
It's a scary thought, Steve Simon, if this is replicating kind of numbers going up on their own. Donald Rumsfeld himself said recently in that so-called private memo that was leaked that he wasn't sure that the U.S. was knocking out more terrorists than were being... Oh, I've lost someone. Are you there, Steve?
I am, yes.
He wasn't sure that they were taking out more terrorists than were being created. What's your sense of that ratio?
Well, you know, terrorists are being created all the time. Now, take, for example, precipitating events or catalyzing events like the war in Iraq. Now, I'm setting aside whatever strategic reasons the U.S. Might have had to invade Iraq, and there was a good strategic rationale, and I'm setting aside the implementation of the war, but the fact is that the U.S. invasion of Iraq validated a very important piece of the movement's agenda, the movement's ideology, which is that the U.S. is implacably opposed to Islam, intends to humiliate it, intends to take over the historical lands of Islam, steal Muslim resources and enslave their people. Now, we all know that's not why the U.S. is in Iraq, but that is how the movement views it, and bin Laden predicted this. He said that this would happen.
That the U.S. would come, that it would prove its color, so to speak.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it, and now we have, and it's been a mobilizing factor.
I mean, this makes it sound as though instead of fighting an organization, the United States and others are now coming dangerously close to that, to really being that clash of civilizations. Is that taking it too far, Steve?
Well, you know, it's problematic. First, you know, as Jason, I think, rightly points out, bin Laden can say what, you know, Simon said in the Gospel of Matthew, you know, when he's told that Jesus is born. He says, "Lord, lettest thy servant depart in peace." And he can well say that because he succeeded in transforming a bunch of, you know, Egyptian killers and Saudi, you know, mystics into a global movement.
And there's a picture. Steve Simon, stand by. We'll get Jason Burke back. We're talking tonight about the Al-Qaeda effect. Is the label Al-Qaeda used too loosely? What if a new wave of copycats inspired by Al-Qaeda has moved beyond Al-Qaeda? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Al-Qaeda effect, about fears of a new wave of terrorists inspired by, but not directed by, Osama bin Laden or any other part of Al-Qaeda. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine a global terrorist movement with no central authority, only a common American enemy? And is it harder to fight Al-Qaeda or a legion of wannabes? Do you think the United States is mopping up terrorists faster than it's creating new ones? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Washington, D.C. by Steve Simon. He's a senior analyst at the Rand Institute, co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, and a former member of the National Security Council. We're joined now from Los Angeles by Josh Meyer, reporter covering terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. Good evening and welcome, Josh Meyer.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us, Josh. We've been looking at this kind of dispersal, what Steve Simon calls the metastasizing of a terrorist movement, as he describes it, along the lines that Osama bin Laden always intended, where it didn't need direction, only a kind of a goal and inspiration. Josh, can you take us into how the U.S. government is attempting to track and confront this much more dispersed terrorist threat?
Well, I know that this concerns them very greatly, and it has for some time now. I mean, Al-Qaeda has morphed and changed and metastasized ever since it, you know, became sort of a global force. They're not sure what to do with this most recent thing. I mean, one of the things that concerns them so much is that Al-Qaeda, such as it is, seems to be testing, you know, the response. I mean, it's pursuing it's monitoring what its pursuers are doing, and it's changing its tactics accordingly. I mean, it's trying to poke holes in our, you know, the Homeland Security, for instance. It's trying to attack targets that aren't being guarded. It's looking very carefully at what's being done to it and then changing that. But, you know, all that being said, I mean, if you remember back in 1996, bin Laden issued what was believed to be his first fatwa or religious decree against the United States, and he said, kill Americans at any time and any place. So, I mean, just, you know, the fact that he said that, you know, he's always acknowledged that Al-Qaeda is not just a, you know, top-down organization. It's also a movement in which he was telling people to go out there and commit acts, you know, in the name of Al-Qaeda without having any connection to the group itself.
Josh, we hear about President Bush kind of crossing off Al-Qaeda leaders as they're captured in the White House. I don't know if that's metaphorical or factual, but is that sort of, you know, slow and steady eating away at the Al-Qaeda leadership still a central focus, or has the anti-terror campaign moved beyond that?
Well, it's moved beyond it. I mean, you can't say that it's one or the other. My understanding was that that was actually a literal thing, that he was doing that. And the joke is that he's now, you know, found his pen again, and he's, you know, starting to drop different lists, I guess. But, you know, I think they are going after people like bin Laden and Zawahiri, for instance, and certainly there's a guy, Saif al-Adel, who's believed to be in Iran, who's now taking over the command aspects of the group, they think. But they also know that they're, you know, that Al-Qaeda has spread and morphed into a couple of different entities, I guess. I think one of the best descriptions I heard was from a guy named Magnus Ransdorp, who is at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, who said that there are several tiers of Al-Qaeda. There's, you know, your central command and control group, and then you have regional commanders, people like Hambali, who was captured in South Asia. Then you have a third tier, who are people that went through the camps, which is as many as 100,000 people. Nobody really knows.
100,000 may have gone through the camps in Afghanistan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of dispersal power.
I think that's a little high, but you know, the estimates are anywhere from 15,000 to 100,000. Steve, I'd love to hear what Steve thinks about that. But, you know, and then you have the bottom tier, which is probably most problematic for them, and that is people that are sort of just taking up the issue without any kind of direction or guidance or funding, because those are the ones that are impossible to catch.
Steve Simon, on this point of how this threat is being addressed, we seem to have lost Jason Brooks' line for a moment, but I know that one of his opinions here is that this can't be addressed through policing, that it becomes so widespread that while policing is always necessary, the hearts and minds angle gets even more essential because there's no other way to kind of mop this up. What's your view?
Well, there's no question the hearts and minds thing is essential to limit recruitment, limit the appeal of violence as a way of resolving disputes. Having said that, you know, we speak in a secular language. We in the West, we in the West feel it's essentially illegal or out of bounds to express our political objectives in religious terms. We just don't do that. In Europe, where we have to count, on allies for cooperation, not only is religious language in public out of bounds, but personal piety is really out of the picture. Yet we have this adversary or potential adversary, this other community out there whose hearts and minds we want to win, that uses a language entirely different, that uses a religious language, and that uses terminology, vocabulary, ideas, concepts that we really don't share, and or if we do, we don't think that they're the legitimate media for dialogue, for the resolution of disputes. So, you know, we need to find a way to cross that secular religious divide, because they're not.
Because they're not crossing it. Josh Meyer, what's your sense in the community charged with fighting terrorism? Is there the sense that the U.S. has chosen the right strategy here? President Bush said we will make Iraq the central battlefield in the war on terrorism, and clearly American resources are being poured in there. The Pentagon may think that's the right thing to do, but fighting terrorism is ultimately not their top responsibility, is it?
No. And in fact, I know a lot of people that even long before we went to war in Iraq, were throwing up their hands at the response and dreading that possibility, because they, you know, rightly believed that by going to war in Iraq and becoming an occupying army, we were essentially recreating the same conditions that we did in 1983 in Beirut, which is we were seen as an occupying force that was unjustly, you know, taking over a Muslim land. And
that the Soviets did in Afghanistan.
Right. And then if you remember in Beirut in 1983, that's when Hezbollah basically bombed us out of there and Reagan pulled out. So I know a lot of people in the FBI and even the CIA and other places that that will never say this publicly, but certainly believe that the war on terrorism, is one thing, and that Iraq, if anything, has made that more complicated and probably harder, because it's created a lot of very radicalized young militants who might not have, I think they call them the fence sitters, who might not have gotten into the action unless something like this had happened.
The fence sitters, until they become, I read somewhere recently, Kleenex kamikazes, you know, young men rapidly radicalized, used, maybe in suicide bombings, and then discarded. Josh Meyer, Steve Simon, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. John is calling from Burrillville, Rhode Island. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
I was wondering, actually, if something like this independent groups, could actually end up working against al-Qaeda, in that ones that go off and don't follow a clearly definable objective other than destruction might lose the support of moderate or sympathetic Muslims that would be someone that could be brought on board to enact in a suicide bombing, like such as happened in Istanbul, where they ended up murdering other Muslims.
So many Muslims, and a big response there that was very negative. It's a great question. Thanks for raising it, John. Steve Simon, how about it? Is there a danger here that in spreading out, diffusing, that the message gets splintered and actually provokes a Muslim backlash against this, or not?
Well, I certainly hope that happens. There was a bit of a backlash that you could see in the press, mostly in editorializing in the Arabic language media, after the attacks in Istanbul and Riyadh. On the other hand, people who are favorably, impressed by the jihad movement and its aims will look at this collateral damage and they'll say, well, you know, it's collateral damage.
You mean the Muslims who died? Sorry,
correct,
about it, but that's part of the campaign. It's price of war.
And they will say, look, if those people were there willingly, then they associated themselves with the enemy, and they were therefore under the sentence of death anyway. And if they were there unwillingly, if they were being held somehow captive and killed in the course of the war, well, then they're martyrs.
Josh Meyer, I wonder what your sense is of how tight a message al-Qaeda or bin Laden, if we want to frame it that way, requires to push forward the organization's goals, his goals. I mean, how tightly tailored does this have to be? Or is kind of anti-Americanism, anti-Westernism enough?
Well, I know that I know that at the heyday of the training camps in Afghanistan, there was a lot of weapons training, explosive training. When you went to the advanced camps, you'd learn poisons and assassinations and so on. But excuse me, there was a lot of training also in ideology and strategy and so forth. And I mean, a lot of this was discussed. I mean, trying to stay on point, as it were, to the message. Also, you know, when they released these tapes to Al Jazeera or whoever, I mean, they were trying to sort of articulate a message that, that does change over time, but they try to come back to the same themes. And one of them has been, especially as they've been on the run and trying to sort of spread their, broaden their base of support, one of the things they've gone after, you know, are these so-called dens of iniquity where Muslims living in places like Saudi Arabia and others are sort of seen as associating with the Americans or Western, allies or even Arab governments that support them.
And not only there, but in Morocco and Indonesia, other places, we've seen them go after hotels with lots of foreigners or where right. locals and foreigners interact.
Right. Well, I think that the second bombing in Riyadh, the one just recently, as Steve mentioned, was very important in the sense that they did target a residential area that was believed to be, mostly Muslims. And it still remains to be seen whether that was on purpose or not, but as somebody in one of the intelligence agencies told me, he said, the intel, the perception in the public was clearly that this was a place frequented by Muslims, and it's not like they got the wrong address. I mean, they had done their surveillance pretty carefully on this. Afterwards, I saw something fairly remarkable, which was that in one of their, missives, Al-Qaeda, I think, actually apologized for it. They said something to the effect of, I think in Istanbul,
okay.
Where they said the death car was in the wrong place and killed too many Muslims. And I think what they were trying to do was say, we didn't mean to do that. But clearly they have also said that, if you are living in a, if you are a Muslim, if you're associating with Westerners, you're fair game to be attacked.
Steve Simon, I'm still trying to sort out in all this, though, while it may be a kind of strength for this willingness to commit terrorism to spread, does it really mean that Al-Qaeda or the movement has become stronger? We have not seen attacks, certainly not major attacks, really none, on the American soil. The bombings in Riyadh were widely interpreted as weak in that they went after very soft targets that didn't even have much of a foreign presence. So what do we have here on balance, stronger or weaker?
This is a generational conflict, as I mentioned, and it's going to have ebbs and flows. Now, having said that, soft targets were on the agenda before September 11th. They're on the agenda after September 11th. The group is committed to killing people. That's what they want to do, and they have an elaborate rationale for doing it. And, it doesn't matter if they kill civilians or military people. You kill as many people as you can conveniently kill. So I don't take comfort in their attention to so-called soft targets.
But isn't the impact substantially different when you're talking about a consulate in Istanbul as opposed to the Twin Towers, 100, 200, many fewer dead as opposed to 3,000 or so? I mean, why hasn't there been an attack on the United States?
You need to recall that the group lets years go by between really major attacks, between the really serious ones, because they take a lot of planning and determination. Videotapes of the World Trade Center were found in Kandahar that had been made 5 years before September 11th. We don't know what the cadre is dreaming up. We know that they tell stories to one another because you can read them on the net, or you can buy them in bookshops in London, in which terrible things happen to New York City and other American population centers, and people are massacred in huge numbers. This is something that they would like to do. It remains a key objective. It takes a long time to get around to doing that. Since September 11th, when they did kill nearly 3,000 Americans, the group has been, A, under a lot of pressure, and B, America has become a somewhat harder target.
There's a key word. Let me get one more call here. Ed, before the break, Ed's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a quick question for the speakers.
Yes.
Why is it none of these countries, including the U.S., ever thinks about going to the source of the problem, which in most cases of this terrorism happens to be poverty? Why don't they say, let's go to these countries, let's see if we can improve the economy? So that all these people, these uneducated, illiterate people who are weaned away into these madrasas, can actually say, you know, we are happy with our lives here. We don't need to go become a terrorist.
But Ed, what about that? I mean, George Bush would say, well, we're trying to rebuild Iraq right now. Turkey's long been part of the Western sphere. Saudi Arabia, where so many of the 9/11 bombers came from, is sitting on an ocean of oil. There are resources and efforts underway.
Yeah, that is true. But if you look at least 50%, if not more. Look at examples like in countries like in Pakistan or Indonesia or even Africa. What problems might those people have other than abject poverty?
And a lot of that, Ed, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Josh Meyer, what about it? What portion of the U.S. effort do you see as aimed at kind of, you know, drying up the sea of terrorists rather than trying to pick them off one at a time?
Well, I think the short answer is not enough. I mean, I think I saw a figure recently that I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was some ridiculous amount of money that's being spent on, you know, winning the hearts and minds of people in the
ridiculous
world,
large or small?
Or overseas, excuse me. I'm sorry?
Ridiculous large or small?
No, ridiculously small. And I think a Blue Ribbon Commission just came out with the same thing and said the United States is not doing a very good job of sort of selling itself, you know, around the world. But it's more complicated than that because we have certain foreign policies that we can't get away from, and you know, so we can't win the hearts and minds unless we address some of their problems. I've heard some of the authorities within the United States say that terrorists out there, you know, are motivated simply by a hatred of freedom, and I think it's much more complicated than that. Most of the 19 hijackers were middle class people. But recently I've been in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia and some similar places, and I can tell you that, you know, that they are powder kegs, that there's a tremendous amount of unemployment. There's a lot of, in Saudi Arabia, for instance, there's a lot of young people who are very, very disaffected, tons of unemployment. They see their government as being corrupt and siding with the United States. So there's a very large reservoir of people that are very susceptible to being recruited into these groups.
And it sounds like they're being recruited at a pretty good clip right now. Josh Meyer, Steve Simon, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the Al-Qaeda effect, fears of a new wave of terrorists inspired by, not directed by, Osama bin Laden. You can join the conversation. What does the rash of recent attacks say to you about the battle for hearts and minds? And what's your gut tell you is the United States winning the war on terrorism? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Al-Qaeda effect, fears of a new wave of terrorists inspired by, not directed by, Osama bin Laden. You can join the conversation tonight. What if a new wave of copycats inspired by Al-Qaeda has spread beyond Al-Qaeda? Can you imagine a global terrorist movement with no central authority, only a common American enemy? Does Washington have the right strategy in the war on terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Los Angeles by Josh Meyer, reporter covering terrorism for the Los Angeles Times, and from Washington by Steve Simon, senior analyst at the Rand Institute, co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. And right now from Madison, Wisconsin, by Raj. Hi, Raj. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling to suggest that an alternative approach would be to try to strengthen and support and encourage the moderates in Islam in a way that I think they need to be supported. The Western media often denigrate the culture of the that part of the world, the Arab culture. Give you a simple example. No one ever comments about an Orthodox Jew wearing a yarmulke or Orthodox Jewish women wearing scarves. And yet when they see Muslim women wearing scarves, they say, okay, they're being oppressed. My grandmother used to always wear a babushka style, kerchief and wear a shawl on her head whenever she went outdoors.
Raj, do you think this really boils down to a conversation about how people are described wearing a veil? I mean, isn't it the bigger policy issues which have a bigger impact?
The bigger issue, in my opinion, is the way the people in the Islamic world see the West expects them to westernize, that modernization equals westernization. They look at what happened to Japan after the war and the Americanization of Japan, and they don't want the same thing to happen to their culture.
It became an awfully rich country with a lot of Japanese culture still. But I take your point. Raj, let me put it to Josh Meyer. Josh, do you hear a conversation about outreach to moderate Muslims, or has Washington already kind of given up that path?
No, they haven't given up. I mean, it might not be the most well-funded part of the war on terrorism, but I do know that the State Department is trying to get up and running some sort of program. They hired a woman, I can't remember her name, who was supposed to be a wizard in Manhattan in terms of helping sell
More than a year ago. But how does that stack up against
Tuckweiler, I guess.
Right, but there's a war going on, and there are major policy initiatives which seem very much larger than any conversation with moderates or anyone else.
Right. I mean, I think we just fairly recently started a sort of Muslim sort of Voice of America to try to sort of reach out to people as well. But no, I mean, it's going to be tough going. I think it's we're trying to enlist the help of moderate Muslims. I know we're doing that, but I think that there's also miscommunications on both sides. I mean, I think that that moderate Muslims themselves, it's kind of a mouthful, are also not as vocal as they could be in saying, hey, that there's a lot of people that are followers of Islam that are very peaceful. I think that in some ways bin Laden and people like him have sort of hijacked or co-opted it. And when most people that are Americans think of Islam, they think of this very militant anti-Western thing, when that's not necessarily the case.
Steve Simon, how would you prescribe a solution for staunching this flow, this new flow of young men to terrorism in the Islamic world?
Well, you have to take a very long-term approach, and the administration has actually cobbled together the elements of such an approach in the form of something that they call their Middle East Partnership Initiative. And it's, of course, much of the money that was originally allocated for it has now been sucked away by the need to spend a lot of money in Iraq.
But is Iraq part of that policy? I mean, Wolfowitz says, here's what you do. You plant democracy, you roll it across the region, and you pray that it sprouts.
Well, let's say that, maybe that's how it'll work, but maybe that's not how it'll work, and maybe the problem is a lot bigger than Iraq. In that case, you want to be spending money in a lot of other places, and programs for those other places get crowded out by the need to rebuild this one particular country. But that's a fact of life, and we need to accept it at this point. The thing about the State Department initiative is that it aims, A, to empower women, who have the most to lose under Islamist regimes. And it aims to create the kinds of civic associations out of which democracy grows naturally over the long term. The administration also aims, believe it or not, I sound like a real advocate of the administration.
Well, it just sounds so pallid compared to the huge resources being poured into these other efforts. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, bear in mind, if you want to talk about poverty, the population in the Middle East is going to grow by over 30% over the next 10 years. Already, if you take an average throughout the region, unemployment among young males is something like 25%. It's going to get a lot worse because there is virtually no, and I mean no, foreign direct investment in many of these countries.
Well, this sounds like a much more hospitable.
There are going to be no jobs, and there are going to be a lot more people. Urbanization is going to proceed very rapidly, so people are going to be living in more squalor, and water is going basically to go away.
This sounds like a perfect petri dish for terrorists, not the opposite. Let me get another call.
The point I'm making is that it goes way beyond the ability of the United States to fund.
Well, okay, a fair and good point. They are sitting on a lot of oil in a number of countries in that region. If the will was there, mean, but I think that the bigger issue is here, we've already got circumstances in play pushed by the United States, which may actually be cutting against us in some degree. Mike's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
All the time, whenever Bush defends his Iraq strategy, he cites terrorism as a reason. Now, we all know now, despite Cheney's efforts to the opposite, that Hussein had absolutely nothing to do with September 11th. And before we even started this war, it was clear that this Hussein-Al-Qaeda connection was bogus. It seems to me that actually the opposite of what Bush is saying is true. Now that we have invaded, sure enough, Al-Qaeda and anyone else who wants jihad against the U.S., they're in Iraq right now. I think that George Bush's entire premise that the fight in Iraq was a fight against terrorism before we got there is absolutely ridiculous. I think we've encouraged it, and the only reason we're fighting terrorism in Iraq is because we brought it on ourselves.
Well, let's take the question out of that then, Mike, if I may, and put it to Steve Simon. Steve Simon, is Iraq proving a greater rallying point for terrorists, or, you know, beacon of future democracy at this point?
Well, the evidence actually is ambiguous. The spokesman for the administration, both from the command in Iraq, from Jerry Bremer's office in the Coalition Provisional Authority, and in Washington, have said different things at different times about the degree to which foreign infiltration accounts for the violence directed against American troops as well as multilateral organizations like the Red Cross and the UN. So, you know, who knows? I can say, however, that the view of Ricardo Sanchez, the three-star general who is the on-scene commander in Iraq, that it's great, actually, that we're in Iraq because we can fight terrorists there so that we don't have to fight them in the United States, is probably mistaken. We know enough about the organization's aims with respect to the United States and its attempts to establish a presence here that the jihadists are going to try hard to attack us in America regardless of what's going on in Iraq.
And when you see attacks being carried out in Turkey, in Saudi Arabia, and much further afield in Morocco, Indonesia, Pakistan, Philippines, do you feel that the war in Iraq has turned up the heat under these far-flung groups, these satellite groups or less from al-Qaeda, led them to do these things?
Now, remember, these kinds of attacks were taking place before the invasion of Iraq. They've been going on for several years, and there was a surge in these attacks after September 11th because that was the real motivating and mobilizing thing. People around the world with grievances could see that one could strike a blow against the enemy, and so they are.
What's your sense then, Steve Simon, about how to optimize an effort to turn this around? If we've got Osama, as you say, metastasizing, with Iraq, as you say, validating Osama bin Laden's central tenet that the U.S. is implacably opposed to Islam, what does this suggest in terms of U.S. strategy, in terms of U.S. next steps?
Well, a strategy has to be composed of several parts. One is we need to strengthen ourselves here at home. The homeland security effort needs real, strong, urgent attention. And one reason for this is that it's not just that the jihadists want to attack us here. It's that they're seeking weapons of mass destruction. And if they can turn such weapons against us here at home, we will suffer greatly. So we need to focus on homeland security. Secondly, we need to carry on with the kind of police and intelligence work on our own and in cooperation with other countries that has been going on, finding these people where they can be found and taking them out of action one way or another. But third, we have to focus on hearts and minds, and that means trying to press, and this is a long-term proposition, trying to press for democratization. In these countries, because the more democratization there is, the more accountability there will be on the part of governments. And the more accountability there will be, the better those governments will be run. And the more of a sense these people will have of having a stake in their future right there and not having to focus on the far enemy, as they call the United States.
So is Iraq a step toward that democratic movement in your mind, or not, Steve?
It could well be. It could well be. I'm not willing to reject it. I think it could work out, and we can't cut and run. We need to stick to this and make it work, because if it does, it helps us greatly, and if it doesn't, we're going to be severely hurt.
Josh Meyer, what a picture that presents. On the one hand, Steve describes Iraq, and you have as well, describes Iraq as kind of inflaming passions, pushing more people toward terrorism. And if it's a generation-long struggle, maybe democracy at the other end pushes back, but it seems like a kind of race here in time.
Well, yeah, and as usual, Steve puts it more articulately than anybody. I found myself sort of wanting to agree on the phone. I mean, yeah, it's a multi-tiered approach. I mean, I, having had the opportunity to interview some of our allies in the war on terrorism, personally, I can tell you that a lot of them, you know, do sort of indicate how deep the problem is. I mean, when I was in Pakistan talking to some of their counterterrorism people, the first thing they started launching into me on was how the United States is causing most of these problems by not trying to help and probably hurting the situation between Israel and you know, the Palestinian groups. They say that we need to resolve the Kashmir issue between India and Pakistan, Chechnya. I mean, we've gone out of our way to be friends with Russia, and we've allowed Russia, according to some critics, to really make the situation worse in Chechnya. And Chechnya has now become one of the biggest battlegrounds for militants, just as much as Iraq has. I think that we have to look at really broad issues of foreign policy and how we can not just, try to get democratization going in other countries, but also look hard at what our policies are and see if there's a way we can sort of, you know, work with that. I also think that there are a lot of problems in terms of law enforcement and intelligence. I mean, all you have to do is listen to President Bush's first, one of his first campaign ads, and he's talking about how all you need is one vial of something to be snuck into the United States, or, you know, one bad cargo, and it could cause destruction on a magnitude that dwarfs September 11th. And I know that they are absolutely petrified that something like that could be happening. I think that a lot of the intel that's been coming out recently that's sort of held very closely right now is that there is some kind of effort underway right now to launch a spectacular mass casualty attack, perhaps in the United States or elsewhere. And I know a lot of people within government that think that sort of like the shark in Jaws, that there's something out there that they don't really know what it is, but that it could dwarf September 11th.
Steve Simon,
a lot of people to, you know, not sleep at night.
I'm sure it does. Steve, we just have a minute left. You describe a generation-long struggle here. In your view, does it get worse before it gets better?
Yeah, I would think so, because the underlying conditions are going to get worse before they get better. And those are structural features of the landscape. I mean, we can't really affect those, even if we had a really big foreign aid program.
Well, there's a picture. Terror well beyond al-Qaeda and growing. Steve Simon, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Steve Simon, senior analyst at the Rand Institute and co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror, Radical Islam's War Against America. And Josh Meyer in Los Angeles, you're a good sport for hanging with us on a rough phone. Thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're very welcome.
You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.